I am Bill Courtwright with Living Right with Bill Courtwright, and this is the Stress Mastery Podcast, where we take you from the science to the spirituality of stress mastery.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Stress Mastery Podcast. I am your host, Bill Courtwright, and I am here with the super millennial, David Barreto, giving us the millennial perspective. Big Dave, how you doing, big guy?
I'm doing good.
So this week, our topic is embrace failure. And a weekend edition of the Stress Mastery Podcast, host Mark Middlestead kicked it off with the fear of failure on Monday with the super millennial. The episode David did was on why do we avoid accepting success? This week's Health Huddles, we talked on the process. In Meeting of the Minds, we introduced the offload principle. In yesterday's Connection Thursday, we talked on the power of the heart. In today's book study, we will continue the Book of Joy by Archbishop Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama. So we are in a part of the book that's going to end this section. It's actually a long section. And next week, we're going to go into days four and five, which are the eight pillars of joy. For today, we are in the section of meditation. Now I'll tell you a secret thing. We arrived at the Dalai Lama's complex early in the morning as the sun was still waking up. We went through the vigilant security, which reminded us that not all were as loving toward the Dalai Lama as he was toward them. I decided to see the pat-down, not unlike those we often are subjected to at airports, as a brief massage rather than an intrusion of my personal space or an accusation of my potential danger. I was already learning how much one's perspective shaped one's reality. We crossed a brief distance to the Dalai Lama's private residence. We were later told that some people who had worked with the Dalai Lama for 30 years had never been inside. This was his retreat, one of the few places where a very public man could experience solitude, and it was a great privilege to be welcomed to the inner sanctum. We followed the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop into the house as the now brightening light streamed in through the glass window panels. The curtains were held back with ties, and the ceiling was painted black and red. The hallway was hung with brightly colored tangas, and the hall was narrowed by bookshelves piled high with golden spin sacred texts. Now, this is my, how do you say, living room, a prayer room, the Dalai Lama explained. It seemed fitting that his living room was a prayer room, since so much of his life is spent in prayer and meditation. As we entered the room, we saw a large glass in altar with a statue of a somewhat emaciated Buddha. Along the sides of the case were traditional Tibetan sacred texts, which looked like rectangular blocks. As we entered the room, we saw a much larger altar, which was encased in glass. Now, this statue, the Dalai Lama said, introducing the Archbishop to the standing Buddha at the center, is from the 7th century. Am I right? The Dalai Lama asked, turning to Hinpa. Right, 7th century, Hinpa confirmed. He was a member of the monastery where the statue once stood, the Dalai Lama said, pointing to Hinpa, known as the Khairang Yawo, literally the brother from Khairang. This statue of the Buddha is revered as one of the most precious religious treasures of the Tibetan people. It was clothed in a traditional Tibetan robe and crowned with a golden jewel coronet. It was surrounded by dozens of smaller statues of the Buddha and other sacred figures was framed by white and purple orchids. Wonderful, the Archbishop said. Originally, there were two similar statues, both carved from single piece of sandalwood. And since the time of the fifth Dalai Lama, one was housed in the Potala Palace. The Dalai Lama explained, the great fifth, as he is often called, lived in the 17th century and united central Tibet, ending its many civil wars. While one statue was in Potala, he said, this statue was in western Tibet. They were like two brothers, twins, So eventually when the Chinese army destroyed Potala, that one was killed. It might have been a misspoken word, but his personification of the statue and its death did seem quite poignant. Then the monks in the Western Tibet smuggled this one out of Tibet and into India. So then there was the question of whether it should go with the monks of the monastery to the south of India, where they were resettled, or stay here with me. I made some investigations, and in the mysterious ways, divination, which I think you also have in African culture. So then this statue, how do you say he spoke in Tibetan to Henpa, who then translated, the divine revealed that the statue preferred to stay with the one who is more famous. Everyone laughed. Now, I'll tell you a secret thing, something quite unique. Each morning you see I pray to this statue. Then I see his facial expression changing. The Dalai Lama had a mischievous look and it was hard to know whether he was pulling the archbishop's leg. Really? The archbishop said, trying not to sound too incredulous. The Dalai Lama rocked his head from side to side as if to say, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Then the archbishop asked, does it smile? Yes, it is smiling like you. Really? The Dalai Lama said as he leaned in and touched the forehead of the archbishop. Then, wagging a finger at him, he added quickly, oh, but not like your eyes, so big and round, the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama's eyes went wide with an expression that could be surprise, fear, or anger. Okay, now our session. But as he walked to his chair, he stopped to another altar in the center of the room. On the round table was a very lifelike crucifix carved out of white marble, with black nails sticking out of the palms of the hands. There was also a statue of Madonna. Now, this is the Black Madonna from Mexico. The statue was of Mary wearing a golden robe and crown, holding a golden orb of the world. On her lap was a small baby Jesus. Mary is a symbol of love, the Dalai Lama said, gesturing to the statue with the same open palm of the sandalwood Buddha. It's wonderful. Dalai Lama showed the archbishop over to a heavily cushioned beige chair with a high wing back. The archbishop wore a navy blue Tibetan shirt with a button in the corner and near the shoulder, which made the shirt seem like a pouch into which he had been snugly fit. The archbishop sat down and his small frame practically disappeared in a large chair. Originally, I also used to sit on the floor, the Dalai Lama said, but I started to have a problem with my knees. So now I prefer like this. And he gestured to a wide chair draped in red, velvety fabric. Because of our program today, I started my meditation at 2:30. The archbishop said, perhaps still marveling at the very early rising. Then, as usual, I shower, then continue with my meditation practice. Now, you feel okay. Temperature is okay, the Dalai Lama was extending his hands with concern. The archbishop smiled and gave him a thumbs up. Thank you, the archbishop said as he settled in beside each other. This part is a clear light of death meditation, the Dalai Lama said, as if we were about to lead us into a meditation focusing on the breath and not wasting away of our bodily form. We are training our mind by going through quite a detailed process for what we will experience at the time of death. The archbishop said with wide eyes, as if he had just been invited to warm up for a spiritual Olympics with a short marathon. According to Buddhist psychology, there are different levels of consciousness, the Dalai Lama said, referring to the esoteric Buddhist tradition, which aims to help the practitioner discover ultimate truth. There's a disillusion that occurs as the grosser level of our bodily and mentally states come to an end, and when more and more subtle levels become manifest. Then at the innermost or most subtle level, this state of clear light arises at the moment of dying. Not death, dying. Physical feeling completely ceases. breathing ceases, heart ceases, it's no longer beating, brain also ceases its functioning, still, subtle, very subtle levels of consciousness remain, getting ready for another destination of life. The consciousness at that moment of death that the Dalai Lama was describing is free of duality and content and abides in the form of pure luminosity. So in Buddhist thought, the Dalai Lama explained, we speak of death, intermediate state, and rebirth. In my case, I undertake this kind of meditation 5 times in a day. So on a daily basis, I kind of go through death and rebirth. 5 times I leave, 5 times I come back. So I suppose, said the Dalai Lama, when I actually die, I should be well prepared. With these words, his twinkling eyes and mischievous smile became thoughtful and tender. But I don't know. When actual death comes, I hope I will have the ability to apply this practice effectively. I don't know. So I need your prayers. The Chinese say you will not decide who your reincarnation will be, the Archbishop said, returning to a source of humor throughout the week. For the Archbishop, once one did not want to miss the opportunity to link prayer to politics and meditation to activism or a good joke. Certainly the declaration the Chinese government, which does not sanction or accept religion, would choose the next reincarnation of the Dalai Lama as a fodder for another good laugh. I prefer after my death, the Dalai Lama said with a laugh, that you search for my reincarnation, that you carry the investigation rather than the anti-religious, atheist, communist government. Yes, the Archbishop said after a pause, perhaps wondering how he would carry out such an investigation to find the next Dalai Lama. Dalai Lama took off his glasses. His beautiful face was familiar and yet suddenly quite different. His face looked long and oval. From his wide, balding scalp over his triangular eyebrows and slightly open eyes, so his straight, broad nose and peaked cheeks that looked chiseled now and weathered like the cliff face of the Himalayan summit, then to his straight and pursed lips, ending with a soft, rounded chin, he looked down as if the shades of his mind had been drawn and now he was concerned only with the inward journey. The Dalai Lama scratched his temple, and I felt relieved that he was not some ascetic who would deny his itches and aches. He wrapped his cloak more tightly around his shoulders and settled into a quiet, his hands resting on his lap. At first, my mind started racing. I was having a hard time staying focused, thinking about the question I would ask, the questions I would ask, the video camera that was filming, the other people in the room, as if everything was as it should be and everyone had what they needed. Then as I watched the Dalai Lama's face, my own mirror neuron system seemed to resonate with the mind state that I was witnessing. Mirror neurons allow us to imitate others and experience their internal states, and therefore may play an important role in empathy. I started to experience a tingling in my forehead, then a sharpening of focus as various parts of my brain started to quiet and calm, as if the activity began to center on what spiritual adepts have called the third eye, what neuroscientists call the middle prefrontal cortex. Daniel Siegel had explained to me that the neural integration created by this crucial area of the brain links many areas and is the locus of everything from the emotional regulation to morality. Meditation, he and other scientists have proposed, helps with these processes. He explained that the integrative fibers of the discerning middle prefrontal cortex seem to reach out and soothe the more reactive emotional structures of the brain. We inherited the reactivity of this part of our brain, and particularly the sensitive amygdala, from our skittish fight or flight ancestors. Yet so much of the inner journey means freeing ourselves from the evolutionary response so that we do not flip our lid or lose our higher reasoning when facing stressful situations. The real secret of freedom may simply be extending this brief space between the stimulus and the response. Meditation seems to elongate this pause and help expand our ability to choose our response. For example, can we expand a momentary pause between our spouse's annoyed words and our angry or hurt reaction? Can we change the channel on the mental broadcasting system from self-righteousness, indignation, how dare she or he speak to me like that, to compassionate understanding, she or he must be very tired. So the Archbishop cradled his right hand in his left. He hung his head in concentration. The goal was meditation. But I've never been quite sure where meditation ends and prayer begins, or where prayer ends and meditation begins. I have heard it said that prayer is when we speak to God and meditation is when God answers. Whether it is God answering or some wiser part of our own intelligence, I am not sure it mattered to me. As I was trying to quiet the inner noise and listen through the thick and enveloping silence. After the Dalai Lama ended the meditation, it was the Archbishop's turn to share his spiritual practice. The Archbishop begins his day with prayer and meditation in a small closet-sized upstairs chapel in his home in Cape Town. Before becoming the Archbishop of Cape Town, his family lived in Soweto, the former black township outside of Johannesburg. That was so central to the anti-apartheid struggle that the site of Soweto uprising. As the Archbishop and Mopo got bread and wine ready, the Dalai Lama said, "A Buddhist monk does not take wine or any alcohol. In principle, that is. But today, with you, I'll take a little," he added. "Don't worry, you can rest assured, I will not be drunk." "I still won't let you drink and drive," the Archbishop replied. "This is the first time we get to pray together," the Dalai Lama said. "One Buddhist, one Christian brother. I mentioned to you since 1975, I've been making pilgrimages to different religious traditions. Sometimes it takes a major disaster for followers of all different kinds of faiths to come together to see we are the same human brothers and sisters. I consider what we are doing today to be part of the same kind of pilgrimage. When I look at the statue of Jesus Christ, I am really moved. I think this teacher has brought immense inspiration to millions of people. Now it is time for your meditation." The Archbishop and Mahapu handed out the small prayer booklets and led to the Eucharist, also called Holy Communion. This rite is considered to be the reenactment of the Last Supper, which was a celebration of the Jewish Passover meal. Jesus is believed to have said that his followers should eat the bread, drink the wine as a remembrance of him, and for many Christians, the bread is transformed into Christ's body and the wine into his blood. The Eucharist celebrates Jesus' sacrifice of himself. I had joined the Archbishop for the Eucharist many times, usually as the only Jew, a point that the Archbishop enjoyed pointing out, often adding that I was there to make sure the Eucharist was kosher. As a non-Christian, I did not actually receive communion, so it was a surprise to see the Archbishop and Dalai Lama break convention in both of their traditions. Many Christians, denominations forbid those who are not Christians or even other Christians who are not of their specific denomination, those with whom they are not in full communion, from sharing in the Eucharist. In other words, like so many religious traditions, it defines who is part of the group and who is not. This is one of the greatest challenges humanity faces: removing the barriers between who we see as us and who we see as other. The latest brain scan research suggests that we have a rather binary understanding of self and other, and that our empathy circuits do not activate unless we see the other person as part of our own group. So many wars have been fought, and so many injustice has been perpetuated because we banish others from our group, therefore our circle of concern. The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama are truly two of the most inclusive religious figures of the world, and throughout the week, the theme underlying their teachings was about transcending our narrow definitions and finding love and compassion for all of humanity. The sharing of traditions that we're engaged in that morning was a reminder to put aside our narrow beliefs of self, other, ours, theirs, Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, and Jew, believer, and atheist. It is in English, the Dalai Lama asked as he took the little booklet. It's English, yes. Do you want it to be in Hausa? The Archbishop said, referring to the African mother tongue clicking as he said the word. That one I don't know. For your sake, we will use English. Thank you, the Dalai Lama said. But languages of heaven is Hausa. When you get up there, they're gonna have to find a translator for you. There's a connection, the Dalai Lama said. You see, historians say the first human beings came from Africa, our real ancestors. So God's creation began in Africa. Not very far from my home, the Archbishop replied. The site that they say is the cradle of humankind. So although you look like you look, you are an African. They are all African, the Archbishop finished. We are all African. Some of us were further away from the heat and their complexions change. Now we want to be quiet. Yes, first you should be quiet. Then we will follow, the Dalai Lama said. One last tease before the sanctity descended, although I often felt like for those two men, holiness and lightheartedness were indivisible. Dalai Lama now sat with his lips pursed together. As the service began, he nodded his head attentively. His hands were pressed together, his fingers laced. I knew that each leader was used to serving as a representative of their entire tradition. And Dalai Lama was attempting to offer his respects on behalf of the whole Tibetan Buddhist, perhaps the whole Buddhist community. We finished the prayers and affirmations of the Eucharist with the words, "Peace be with you. The peace of the Lord be with you." Everyone went around to kiss and embrace one another. The Dalai Lama was behind his meditation table. I was thinking about how few embraces he must get and went over to greet him. Now was time for communion. The Archbishop lifted up the small piece of Tibetan white bread, placed it in the Dalai Lama's mouth. Then Mopo approached with a glass of red wine. The Dalai Lama dipped the tip of his left ring finger into the glass and then placed the smallest drop in his mouth. After giving everyone communion, the Archbishop used his finger to collect all the crumbs so not a smidgen of the symbolic body would be discarded, then poured any remaining bits into the glass of watered-down wine and drank it. The Archbishop ended his blessing in Hausa, clicking repeatedly in the beautiful sound poetry of his native language, crossed himself, and then made a sign of the cross over the gathered fellowships. Before we left, the Dalai Lama stopped to take some pills, which he explained were Tibetan medicines. He chewed them up, his face puckering in their bitter taste. "That's why you're looking so handsome," the Archbishop said. "Because of God's grace," the Dalai Lama replied. Rachel then added, "Yeah, God's grace sends the Tibetan doctor." In terms of physical strength, God loves the non-believer more than the believer, the Dalai Lama said, laughing. The Archbishop began to cackle too, as he took his cane and started to walk away, but then turned around. "Don't laugh at your own jokes, man. You taught me to do that." Then the Dalai Lama got up, wrapped his cloak around his shoulders, took the Archbishop's arm. "Thank you very much," he said, referring to the service. "Very impressive. Thank you for your hospitality," the Archbishop replied. A car was waiting, but the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama decided to walk up the path together to the conference room where the interviews were being filmed. Dalai Lama took the Archbishop's hand, the one that held the cane. They walked together nimbly. "Have you had any problems with security here?" the Archbishop said. No, the Dalai Lama said. "Quite surprised," the Archbishop responded. "No," Dalai Lama said again, confirming his safety. "I usually describe myself as the longest guest of the Indian government, now 56 years. It was wonderful that you've been able to secure here. The only danger, Dalai Lama said, is an earthquake. So that ends this actual section of the book. And next week, we will go into days 4 and 5 and the 8 pillars of joy. Long chapter. I wanted to finish it this week, Dave. So we don't have a lot of time here, but give me your thoughts of what you took out of. This was a very interesting chapter, though. Not a lot of comment we really need, right? What did you take out of it?
The big thing that I liked while I was listening to this was being able to still be so different from someone else, but still be able to relate, still be able to joke and do all those things. But the real thing that was the takeaway was being able to go into someone else's religion, belief, and respect it, even though it may not be nowhere near, you know, what that person believes, and then appreciate it, you know, not just, oh, let's get this over with, let's do this. Really appreciate that somebody was embracing you and that you're embracing who they are, because religion and the things that you believe, you know, are a big part of people. And I think being able to have that respect, even if it's not something that you believe in or, you know, follow, is such a huge thing. And I think that would bring so many people together.
I love this chapter. I just like the whole thing. I don't have too much comment. I do want to talk about what Hinpa was talking about, the real secret of freedom. It says here, the real secret of freedom may simply be extending this brief space between stimulus and response. And he was talking about meditation and how meditation, I always tell people the purpose of meditation is to increase the concentration muscle so you can pause, plan. And so that's what he says. Meditation seems to elongate this pause and help expand our ability to choose our response. Next week, I'm going to get more in. We're going to talk on grief next week. We're going to talk about that grief energy because we're going into the holidays. We're going to talk about despair and grief. And some people get very sad during the holidays, right? I want to talk about that. I want to address it. And I want to show you how to get out of it. But we're going to talk more about the heart. And we're going to talk about the practices that connect you to the heart. And one of the practices of stress mastery is the pause plan, right? Is to slow down and do the pause plan. What he's telling you here is exactly what we teach you, is how to get out of the red zone into the green zone, out of the limbic brain into the cortex where you can respond instead of react. That's what meditation does. That's what the scientists are realizing. Meditation strengthens that part of the brain that allows you to slow down instead of just being locked into reaction.
Yeah, I like that he even worded it that it's the ancestral the fight or flight.
Yes.
And then how meditation evolves us because evolution didn't. I was like, wow.
That's exactly right. That
makes so much sense when you say that.
Stress mastery. You know, that's conflict resolution. That is responding. That's everything we're trying to teach is we have to understand as human beings, we function and operate from that ancestral programming. It was 200,000 years of that. And that always puts us in first the fight or flight before we can respond. So you have to be able to break that stress loop. And the only way you can break it is through consciousness. And that's the purpose of meditation. And then the last part before we close out that I thought was good was when he talked about religious. He said, one of the greatest challenges that humanity faces is removing the barriers between who we see as us and who we see as other. And they talk about the latest brain scan research shows that we have this binary understanding of self and other, that our empathy circuits do not activate unless we see other person as part of our own group. That is the want to belong. The want to belong is the need to be part of something and part of a group. That's what goes into, and when we get stuck there, that's when we go into the want of control and we defend and attack. And then what our perception is, our group is right, their group is wrong, and that's what creates wars. And it's stupid. It's just dumb why we do that to each other, because we're all one species, one energy, right?
Yeah, when people say we should get to understand one another, and then there's boundaries such as you're not fully communized or anything like that, it's like, how can I understand you if the wall's in between? And I think that's this whole chapter, I mean, was awesome. But those two main points really, really stuck out to me.
Okay. That's it for today's show. Our mission here is to create a shift in the planet. You can join us on this mission by like, share, and subscribe. Those links are right below the show. As always, until next time, stay inspired.